From the Mutual Broadcasting System, this is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Well, welcome to STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk, and I'm going to kind of get into something that's big in the news. I've been interviewed on multiple networks on this, and as some comments are floating around this week, it has pretty significant implications for the United States, for our foreign policy, for what's happening here in the homeland too. And it's very controversial, and it's a proposal, or I should say a statement that was put out that emanated from, I should say, the Trump administration, about having U.S. forces potentially engage in some sort of strike missions or military actions on the cartels, as we've designated them, the narco-terror cartels, hitting targets in Mexico, the country that we share a huge border with directly to our south. Obviously, that is big. That is certainly much bigger in some ways than the discussion about striking targets in Venezuela. Now, quick recap: Mexican drug cartels, leading suppliers of cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, and other illicit narcotics, if you will, in the United States. That's where most of them come from. And with that said, the cartels, the drug trade as a whole, has fueled rampant corruption and violence in Mexico, and contributed to tens of thousands of homicides every year in Mexico, and the U.S. Death toll, if you will, from drugs is immense. I've heard up to 100,000 a year. But it's a huge. In some places, it's the leading cause of death in certain age categories. Since Mexico launched its if you will, its war on drugs, the war on cartels, in 2006, the U.S. has provided billions of dollars in security and counter-narcotics assistance that has come in a variety of different ways. And Mexican drug trafficking organizations, or DTOs, sometimes referred to as transnational criminal organizations. I prefer TCOs in talking about a lot of these organizations. They just dominate the distribution of not just cocaine, but also fentanyl, which has become a huge thing, although that is tied to precursors that come from Mexico. Recent discussion that Trump had with Xi, as you may recall. Heroin, marijuana. Yeah, marijuana is still being imported. And methamphetamines here in the U.S. Now, the suppliers, Mexican suppliers, are really responsible for most of heroin methamphetamine production. Cocaine is largely produced down south in Colombia, but the primary way of getting it up here is to run it up, shoot around the San Blas area of Panama, and bring it into either a Central American country or into Mexico proper, and then smuggle it into the U.S. And so that's how a lot of that smuggling stuff on the border is actually bringing stuff from down south. Now, Mexico, along with China, as I mentioned, is a leading source for fentanyl, which is a synthetic opioid, 50 times more potent than heroin, very easy to produce, extremely dangerous, and has caused a dramatic spike in the number of drug-related deaths here in the U.S. At one time, the cartels smuggled vast quantities of marijuana in the U.S., and then a bunch of jurisdictions in the U.S. legalized it. However, ironically, like California has a kind of a booming cannabis industry, if you will, which then prompted the DTOs, the drug trafficking organizations, the cartels, to smuggle U.S.-grown marijuana across the border into Mexico, which, believe it or not, and that is where the drug is not legal at all. And so it is kind of weird to see that. But then again, Mexican marijuana is so much cheaper than the legally grown marijuana in the U.S. that two things have happened. One, you have a proliferation of illegal grows in the U.S., and you still have some marijuana smuggling coming into the U.S. as well. Now, a little thing I need to talk about. We talk about corruption in Mexican government, Mexican law enforcement, Mexican military. And a lot of times people just kind of turn their nose up and go, oh my gosh, there's such so much corruption, as if that is some sort of cultural thing in Mexico or some societal problem in Mexico. It's like, well, you know. And I got to tell you, I get very frustrated with that, because Mexican government officials, military, law enforcement are really trying to do the most they can. But there is a phrase in Mexico, and it's not unique to Mexico. There's similar phrases all over the world. But the phrase is plata o plomo, which in English translates to silver or lead. It is a chilling threat that the Mexican drug cartels use to intimidate and pressure individuals into compliance. Basically, it translates to either you take the money or you're going to take the bullet, or something worse than a bullet. And it's not just for you. It will be something aimed at you, your family, everybody you care about. And they basically do an intelligence workup to basically find pressure points to force Mexican officials, whether they're in government or executives or officials in the private sector, to find those pressure points that they can push to get them to cooperate with what the drug trafficking organizations want them to do. All right. So basically, you either take the bribe or you and your family will be dead, is basically what they're saying. It's become a symbol of the violence and corruption that is kind of endemic to the drug trade in Mexico. Again, it's not unique to Mexico. And the cartel's influence and control is huge. I have seen estimates that 25 to 30% of the Mexican economy is tied to the drug business, the drug cartels in Mexico. A lot of the money that went to pay for those huge resorts down in Cozumel and elsewhere in Mexico, that was actually laundered drug money. That was the capital that paid for those drug resorts. Ironically, cartel violence has at times diminished the amount of tourism that goes into Cozumel, which is kind of interesting, because on the other end, that is actually an investment by the cartels, a legitimate business investment that they use to make money. So one part of their trade is actually diminishing the return on investment from another part of their overall revenue scheme, which is always been something of an oxymoron, if you will. Now, U.S. military history in Mexico has been marked by some rather interesting things, not the least of which is the Mexican-American War, or the Mexican War of 1846, about a two-year conflict. It was big. It was under, now we all remember, the James Polk administration. Oh my gosh, don't get me going on that. But it was a war declared on Mexico. It was over disputed border, and eventually resulted in some other interesting things, not the least of which is the U.S. ended up annexing Texas and Arizona, New Mexico, and California. So for the U.S., that war actually took a big chunk of Mexico away, if you will. Then again, in 1914, there was what's called the occupation of Veracruz. This isn't really that well remembered, but this happened during a very tumultuous period of the Mexican Revolution, and the U.S. was concerned about German arms shipments to Mexican President Victorio Huerta, who had seized power through a coup. Woodrow Wilson ordered the U.S. Navy to seize part of Veracruz to basically prevent those arms from reaching Huerta's regime. This resulted in a very violent confrontation between U.S. forces and Mexican forces, leading to casualties on both sides. And the occupation lasted for several months, all right? And there was widespread condemnation throughout Mexico as to what the U.S. had done. You got to remember, this is 1914. I know it seems like a long way away, but, you know, the Mexican-American War ended in 1848. So when you talk about 1914, I know it's like generations, but it's not that many generations. There are people within living memory who would have recalled the Mexican-American War, and it also got international condemnation as well. Now, keep in mind, 1914, that's also the year that World War One kicked off, all right? So World War One is burgeoning across the world. The German forces are trying to do all sorts of things. In the midst of this, a political figure, a bandit, if you will, Pancho Villa, was running around, one of the factions, if you will, in the Mexican Civil War, and he did a cross-border raid into Columbus, New Mexico. And The Pershing Expedition, also known as the Punitive Expedition of 1916-17, under General John Pershing, who was the famous general who led American forces in World War I, well, he went down to Mexico, and thousands of troops went into northern Mexico. Their objective was to capture Pancho Villa, the revolutionary bandit leader, if you will, the one I just talked about, who raided Columbus, New Mexico. It was a significant incursion into Mexican territory. It was conducted without the full consent of the Mexican government, which I kind of will bring us to where we are today. And there was although there was some level of cooperation due to concerns about Pancho Villa's actions, ultimately the expedition did not get Pancho Villa. Actually have some success in really decimating his forces, if you will, and it also demonstrated that the U.S. willingness to conduct military operations on Mexican soil to pursue perceived threats, even if it meant disregarding Mexican sovereignty. I kind of want to point that out because of what's happening now. It's not very well remembered, but within the socio-political fabric of Mexico, at least in the U.S., but with the socio-political fabric of Mexico, it is very well remembered what the U.S. did there and the way that it was done. Now, in the contemporary landscape, if you will, it's been defined by a lot of things. You know, we talked about the 2006 initiative within Mexico to go after the cartels. Well, the U.S. has provided all sorts of assistance, involvement that's framed as really cooperation with the Mexican government, not intervention. The Marina Initiative in 2007 is kind of an example. It was a U.S. security cooperation program that provided Mexico with training, equipment, intelligence to help combat the drug trafficking threat from, you know, organized crime, cartels, and then the violence associated with it. It was not a direct military deployment by the U.S. on Mexican soil in any traditional sense, but involved a lot of resources and a lot of personnel indirectly supporting Mexican security forces. All right. The U.S. provides intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, our ISR capabilities, training, specialized units, advanced weaponries, all these for the Mexican military and their police forces across the board. Now, these are typically framed as defensive or supportive roles. These are very distinct from their past interventions. You know, a lot of these things that we have, such as there's been discussions about deploying surveillance drones and things like that. We have, as far as I know, we are flying over Mexican territory today with drones and with manned intelligence or reconnaissance surveillance aircraft, as far as I know today. And going back at least 15 years, the U.S. has been helping Mexico establish its Intelligence Fusion Center program. The U.S. was down there working with them closely, but we kind of ran into that challenge with sharing intelligence with Mexican authorities. Unfortunately, many times we share intelligence and that would find its way through a weak link into the cartels, and they would be able to anticipate what was going on. Now, the U.S. generally has always emphasized partnership with Mexico, capacity building. From the Mexican perspective, there's always a lot of sensitivity due to the history of the U.S. intervention in Mexico. There's always fear of U.S. overreach, undue influence, if you will, of the U.S. military, and we can be seen as kind of overpowering and literally a threat to their sovereignty. And certainly some of the recent rhetoric has kind of fallen into that, the perception on their end of a threat to their sovereignty. This is a big struggle going against the cartels, and the debate will often center on what type of equipment, what type of support, whatever. And of course, the fear is, what are the unintended consequences of what we do? What are the potential for unintended consequences, those second, third order effects, if you will? Now, this week, the Trump administration has begun, according to reports that went to MSNBC and NBC, but it had been repeated throughout a variety of news outlets out there, that there is planning for a new mission to send American troops and intelligence officers, not quite sure what that last one means, but to Mexico to target the drug cartels. And NBC cites two current Trump administration officials and two former U.S. officials who are very, very familiar with this thing. Now, it sounds like it's very early stages. There's early stages of training for the potential mission. I'm not quite sure what that training would be. Some of it could be Spanish language training. It could be a lot of other things as well. Maybe for those units involved, then they're really kind of focusing on special operations units. They could be looking at doing training on doing raids at drug cartel locations or locations where there are drugs. And some of it could involve, you know, specialized suits and stuff. Maybe not level A, but level B or something like that to avoid contamination if they come in contact with like a load of fentanyl or something like that. That would be reasonable training that I could see going on there. Any deployment to Mexico is not seen as imminent, as near as they can tell. JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, would operate, would basically be running the show, I guess, under for SOCOM. Now, Mexico is part of the U.S. Northern Command's area of responsibility. Venezuela is under U.S. Southern Command, as is most of the Caribbean. So you got two different combatant commanders going on there. My personal history, I've worked for both at various times in uniform. So I'm very familiar with both of them as far as I go. Also, the troops, normally active duty military troops, are under what we call Title 10. As you may recall from some of the National Guard discussions, that's been a big thing that I've talked about a lot. But this would be under a thing called Title 50, which is something that we often use for covert operations and operations where we don't want regular Title 10 folks with all the legal restrictions of Title 10. So they'd be operating under Title 50, and they said there could also be CIA officers involved with this, which I would fully expect to be true. And there was discussion about using drone strikes along with what I kind of talked about before, which is some special operations troops that might be boots on the ground. Now, this story has put President Sheinbaum of Mexico into a very difficult situation, all right? She has already allowed, at least reportedly, allowed CIA to expand its surveillance flights all over, and I think the military has been working with that as well, those flights. And Mexico, under her leadership, has deployed 10,000 troops to the U.S. border, increased fentanyl seizures, extradited 55 senior cartel figures to the U.S. So she's been doing a lot, but this really dredges up that fear of U.S. overreach and a threat to sovereignty. So that is a big concern. So, and then since early September, they've seen what's happened with this change in U.S. policy, with the designation of the narcotics cartels as narco terrorists, and treating those terrorists the same way on the water, the same way that we treat terrorists on land, say in Afghanistan or Iraq or other places, and basically doing strike missions on them. So obviously, all of this, put in context, puts a lot of political strain on Mexico. And just to kind of recap, that somewhere in the mid-60s to upper 60s have been killed. Narcotics traffickers have been killed on the water, particularly members of Tren de Aragua from Venezuela. And there's been at least 16 strikes on 17 boats in the Caribbean and the Pacific, on the Pacific side. So what does this mean? What can we expect? Well, Mexico is a different situation. And what I would expect is that we will probably figure out, as much as there is a political temptation and a lot of pressure to, you know, that's got to go down there and get those cartels. There is a political, diplomatic can of worms that gets opened up that we've never wanted to see happen. And so I would anticipate that when it's all said and done, this planning process, we're going to find a way to do this jointly with Mexican authorities. We're not going to run roughshod over Mexican sovereignty. And the reason why is it's different than Venezuela. We do not see the Maduro regime as a legitimately elected regime. We do not see him as the legitimate leader of Mexico. We see that election that he rigged is one that he clearly lost. The vast majority was for the opposition. The leader of the opposition just won the Nobel Peace Prize, something that President Trump has not been shy about saying he'd like to get someday. And so it's a different situation in Mexico than Venezuela. And I just want to make that very clear. But I think we're going to find some way that we can do these things, but we're going to have to do it in a way that we can contain the information. So when there is intelligence on a potential target and we're working with our Mexican counterparts, that has to be controlled in such a way that it will not go into certain lanes where that intelligence would get shared with the cartels. That's going to be a challenge in Mexico. It's always been a challenge in Mexico, but I think we can kind of work that out. I think at some point we can basically contain this, if you will. They use the term doing special operations. We often talk about quarantine of the strike force in such a way that when something is being planned, we literally quarantine them so they can't talk to anybody until the mission is done. All right. And I think that's kind of what's going to have to happen in a bilateral sense with our Mexican counterparts. So that's what I see happening. Thanks for listening to Strat. Please visit stratpodcast.com, the YouTube channel, Hal Kempfer TV, or the other one where you can also get this podcast separate. And don't forget the Global Risk Intelligence and Planning's corporate website at www.gripsa.com. So thank you for listening, and hope you listen to the next one.